Welcome to Kitchen Window, NPR's food podcast. I'm Bonnie Wolf. There are certain things that are perfect on a hot summer day. A tall glass of iced tea, a thick slice of watermelon, or a bowl of silky cold soup. Getting together the iced tea and the watermelon are pretty easy. Cold soups sound harder than they are. We'll get a few tips. It turns out even doctors are intimidated in the kitchen. We'll hear from some chefs who are trying to help. So, let's dig in. Susie Chang is a New England-based freelance writer and reviews cookbooks for the Boston Globe. She has written a piece on cold soups for NPR's Kitchen Window Online. She joins me today. Hi, Susie.
Hi, Bonnie.
It is the height of the summer heat, so we're going to talk about cold soups today. Who thought up cold soups?
Oh, gosh, Bonnie, you always ask me these hard questions. I don't know. I like to think that it started in the Middle East because you read about, you know, these wonderful early Near Eastern cuisines where they're always having these wonderful cold melon soups and ices and things like that.
Are cold soups in all cultures or in many cultures?
I think in many. I don't seem to run across them as much in the Asian, Japanese, Korean, Chinese cultures.
And it's not just cultures that have cold climates, because Scandinavians eat a lot of fruit soup. Talk about fruit soups a little bit.
Well, fruit soups are delightful. They're the one cold soup you can make with almost absolutely no effort whatsoever. Basically, you put the fruit in the blender and you add some juice. Some people like OJ. I like to put cranberry juice because I like to use red fruit, and it really gives it this beautiful jewel-like color. Hmm. And you just whiz it in the blender and strain it so that you get the little seeds out. If you're using raspberries or strawberries, that's essential. And every soup needs a little something to brighten the flavor, especially if it's a cold soup. We like to put something acid or sour or tart in it. So I like to put a little bit of lemon in my berry soups. And then I sweeten it with a little extra honey.
Hmm. Do you make melon soups?
I have in the past. I remember there was a wonderful, wonderful gourmet cover about 20 years ago. And on the front of it, there was a cantaloupe soup and a honeydew soup. And they'd been poured together so that you had this, you know, yin-yang symbol in the soup plate. It was really entrancing.
Some fruits, like watermelon, has so much liquid in it, you probably don't have to add very much.
Right. And the thing about these fruit soups is that they're really not terribly satisfying. They don't really fill you up. They're the perfect soup for those incredibly sticky, humid, horrible days when the heat's just pouring off your skin. That's what fruit soups are for.
The vegetable soups that we see more often, gazpacho has certainly become iconic of a summer soup. What are some other cold vegetable soups?
Well, I like to make these very smooth cold vegetable soups. I love gazpacho as well. But the smooth vegetable soups are, for example, velvet corn soup. There's a lot of different versions out there, and I've included one in my article. And there's zucchini soup, which I've always adored from the first time I had it in a restaurant in the summer one year. And then there's tomato soup, which you can also have during the middle of the summer, and cucumber soup.
Are these cream-based soups?
They are not, and that's the beauty of them. They're soups in which you use the freshest summer vegetables you can get. And you do them very simply if you can, using just a few flavor enhancers like onion or garlic, something to just give it a little bit of a mellow undertone. And then you just simmer them as you might simmer them for a hot soup, but you do it early in the morning and you cool it down. And in the evening, you have this delicious, deeply flavorful, but totally cold soup.
So a summer tomato soup, what would be involved in making that?
Well, here's the thing. With all of these cold soups, I recommend you do them in the morning every time because the vegetable soups all have some detail-oriented labor involved in the beginning. With the tomato soup, you want to get the really best, most concentrated flavor out of the tomato. You want to roast it or grill it. So I like to grill them and add in a little bit of red pepper because that just seems to emphasize the flavor of the tomato. So I grill the tomato and the red pepper, and then I sweat some onions in a pan and I really let those onions soften down and get juicy and sweet. And then I add in the tomato. Then I blend it all together. And you really want to blend tomato in particular really, really well because, you know, tomato has a tendency to have those little bits. And if you don't blend it really well and strain it really well, you'll taste those when it comes out.
Do you peel and seed the tomatoes?
Well, you do after you've grilled them.
Mm-hmm. You call for a blender. Can you do this in a food processor?
I really think you can't. I've tried many, many times. I've included in this story a list of blender tips at the end, and they are all from hard-won experience. I tried to use a food processor many times making soup, and what happens is that it's so wide, the bowl is so wide and so shallow, that the blade doesn't really get to hit every little bit of the soup. Whereas if you have a blender and you do it in small batches, the soup funnels down around the blade and it goes churning over and over and over again until the soup is just silky fine.
How long do the soups hold?
Oh, you know, I think that they can hold 2 or 3 days. I would re-blend them if you hold them longer than 3 hours.
All right, Susie, thank you so much.
You're so very welcome.
That was food writer Susie Chang. Chefs at the Culinary Institute of America in California would like to help Americans learn to eat better. And they're starting with a key group of diners. Through a collaboration with Harvard University's medical school, the chefs and at least one med student are training doctors to cook. NPR's Allison Aubrey reports.
If you've ever assumed that meals that taste really great must be loaded with all the stuff that's bad for you, well, then meet Michelle Hauser. She's about to demonstrate how you can whip up healthy meals in under 20 minutes for less than $20.
Go ahead and give that a smell.
Mm.
It has like a very musky lime scent.
As she snips sprigs of a citrusy herb from the garden here at the Culinary Institute, Hauser sounds every bit the foodie. But she's a world away from the diet she grew up on and grew heavy on as a kid. One staple was commodity cheese handed out to families like hers living on food stamp budgets. A turning point, she explains, came when she first moved away from home, and she was blown away by all the beautiful fresh food she discovered at a farmer's market.
And so I just started getting all of these really interesting vegetables I had never seen before and picking the farmer's brains as to how I would cook with these things.
Her approach to eating changed gradually, bit by bit, emphasizing a more plant-based diet. A decade later, she's teaching it.
Can you hear me okay? No. Okay, I see some yeses and nos.
With the herbs in hand, Hauser has stepped into the Institute's huge demonstration kitchen. A video feed connects her to a packed classroom of students.
So I'm just going to dump my 2 cans of salmon into this bowl.
Pressing chunks of salmon into a strainer, she talks up all the flavor and the omega-3s packed into the grilled salmon burgers she's about to make.
And I'll tell you, I know that anyone can do this recipe at home because I gave it to someone that absolutely cannot cook. And they made dinner successfully, so that was my acid test for this recipe.
Now, before this all starts to sound like some kind of Rachel Ray cooking show spinoff, what you should know is that this isn't just a cooking class. Michelle Hauser is a professional cook by training, but she's also now a third-year medical student at Harvard, and her students are doctors, too. Many of them want to spend more time focusing on diet, lifestyle, and disease prevention with their patients.
Okay, we're almost there.
Hauser has added some eggs, herbs, spinach, and whole wheat breadcrumbs. As the first of the salmon patties come off the stove, students gather in for a taste test.
It's delicious. It's very good. Very tasty.
Physician Tasha Tomlinson says they taste like a lighter version of the salmon croquettes popular in her culture. With less saturated fat at a cost of about $1 per serving, she says she'll take the recipe back to her patients.
Well, most definitely in my practice, there is like an epidemic of young women who are just overweight and sedentary, and they're always looking to me for things that they can do to get back on track.
Thinking out loud, she says maybe she'll coordinate demonstrations for her diabetes patients who gather once a month.
What if we did this in that diabetes class, then they could learn one new recipe or a couple of new recipes to kind of incorporate into their weekly shuffle.
When people learn from each other by actually cooking, they're less intimidated in the kitchen. Physician Laurie Elliott of Chicago says what she's learning is that she needs to show her patients how to make changes.
You can go to a patient and say, listen, I'm not going to tell you you can't have this and this. I'm going to say, look at all these great new things you can try, and here are some practical strategies for it.
Strategy one is to think about flipping portion sizes on your plate. The protein or meat in a meal should be no bigger than a deck of cards. Instead, build a meal around vegetables. It should be 50% of your plate, then add whole grains and flavors.
Is anybody here tired of black beans and brown rice yet?
In the demonstration kitchen, Culinary Institute instructor Tucker Bunch has students prepare two kinds of whole grains, quinoa and farro.
We can drain and rinse these.
The grains cook just like rice, but offer more texture and flavor.
This is all really nice stuff. It's starting to feel a little Mediterranean, right? A little oregano. Got some edamame, which is a little bit outside the norm, but they're loaded with great nutrition, especially when they're whole.
Edamame are just a type of soybeans. You can buy them in the frozen food section. Bunch adds some baked chicken, some fennel, and he's got a meal.
So here's night one.
But there's still a lot of food left over. So the concept here, explains Bunch, is to cook once, eat three or four times. The extra meals he calls planovers.
I've got some of that nice vegetable stock.
This becomes a soup. He just adds bits of chicken and vegetables. Then he makes a salad, served cold, adding yogurt. Another plate is a drumstick with the vegetables mixed on the side.
So now I've got four meals, one simple combination of pretty basic ingredients, and I cooked it in one pan.
Pulling it off takes a combination of practice and planning. But your local grocery store doesn't need to stock a wealth of exotic, fresh ingredients to make it happen. Remember, Michelle Hauser's salmon burgers were made from canned fish and frozen spinach. Hauser says she did enjoy the time she spent working in restaurants, cooking fancy food. But her calling as a physician seems to be headed towards teaching food.
The biggest aha moment I had was when my students would come back, and these were just people taking one class at a time in the community, would come back and say their blood pressure had improved or, you know, some health benefit had come of it, and it just kept being repeated, and they were just cooking what they loved.
It was Hippocrates who said, let food be your medicine. Hauser's approach isn't far off. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
Thanks for listening to today's Kitchen Window, NPR's food podcast. Go to our website, npr.org/kitchenwindow, for more food stories and recipes. Join us next time for some good summer corn. I'm Bonnie Wolfe.